My name is Jody Kretzman, and I hail from Chicago most of the time, and have been doing a number of things over the past week under the general title After the National Nap, which is particularly appropriate at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when everybody in the room is yawning. Let me just say a word or two about myself and a word or two about the title and then get into the topic this afternoon, which is a chat, hopefully, that can be a chat together about the sort of state of affairs in race relations today in the United States. It's kind of appropriate, I think, that we do that, both because we've been talking during this past week quite a lot about the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and its interesting thrusts toward inclusiveness and multicultural ministry. And we're going in the next 10 days or so to Holden's own set of efforts toward multicultural being, these weeks that we know as Rainbow on the Mountaintop. We thought sort of at the beginning of that period of time, we might just chat with a few folks about where we are in race relations at this point. As I say, I hail from Chicago, and my own glasses through which I view the world are fairly intensively urban. I tend to view things through the realities of cities. And what seems particularly strange, I think, to some people at Holden anyway, I love cities. I absolutely think that particularly the older, troubled, bustling cities of the Midwest and Northeast in the United States are some of the most exciting places on earth. And I like the sort of constant pounding on one's mind and on one's spirit that you get with city life. I also like Holden, where you can get away from that a little bit, but the two together somehow to me seem to be balanced. Chicago, where I work most of the time and have done most of the work that I do on public policy issues, is a place that is terrifically multicultural in itself. It's about now, in terms of percentages, 35% to 40% white, 35% to 40% black, and another 15% or so Latino, and another 6% to 8% Asian. I know those kinds of percentages vary across the country, but I think in some ways Chicago has enough of a kind of critical mass of the major groupings that make up the rainbow in the United States, that it gives us some experience in dealing with all of the complications that interracial relationships have. After the National Nap was the title of a panel that it was actually a sort of debate that a fellow named Roger Rosenblatt and I did before the Foundation community in Chicago a couple of months ago. Rosenblatt is now the editor of U.S. News and World Report and was for many years a columnist for Time magazine, where I used to work too. And I want to tell you this because he and I agreed on more things than we disagreed. And it was surprising to me because Roger is a lifelong Republican and a fairly conservative individual. And we were trying to assess for the Foundation community in this sort of debate sort of the state of the United States and as we go into the 90s, and we settled together on this title, After the National Nap. The idea, I think, basically, as I said to people in some earlier sessions, is that whatever one thinks about the Reagan years in the 1980s, and I think sort of beginning about the mid-70s, the focus in the United States for citizens of this country has been almost entirely personalistic, almost entirely privatized. That is, what matters to people is my own well-being, is at most sort of my family's well-being. Sometimes that's sort of defined in very narrow, material, consumerist kinds of terms, so that the rise of the yuppies and so forth in some ways will come to characterize the 1980s, but sometimes it can be characterized in a somewhat broader way, so that we're interested in our spiritual health or in our, you know, in broader aspects of our mental health, in small group relations. But in any case, the focus is on self, is on the private life, is on the personalized set of realities, and it's not on the public realm. There's been very little discussion in the last decade, serious discussion, about the civic good, right? About the good society, or what we used to, you know, what Lyndon Johnson labeled the great society in the late 1960s. The discussion about the public realm, about what John Newhouse called the public square, the social good, has simply been absent from the mainstream of discourse in the United States. So that in terms of thinking about being a good society, about progress in any kind of larger group terms, social, economic, political terms, we've been, I think, asleep. We've been napping. We've been following our president in his definition of the way in which one or groups of people think about reality. I think that Republicans and Democrats and independents alike are beginning to see that that exclusive focus on a privatized reality has begun to accumulate a series of neglected agendas, a series of problems that we haven't thought about during the last decade, and problems that are going to be upon us in some serious and visible ways that even the privatized U.S. citizen can't ignore in pretty quick order. So the general rubric then of a series of stuff that I've been doing has to do with this notion of a national nap, that we've been asleep for about a decade, and that there are some stirrings now that we're awake, that we're beginning to wake up, that we're beginning to think about how to address some of this accumulated agenda of problems. And I think one can come at that set of questions from a number of angles. We talked a little bit earlier this week about the economy and the ways in which the privatized thinking about the economy has caused a whole lot of problems to begin to accumulate. One can go at, I think, a whole series of environmental and ecological issues that are beginning to come to people's consciousness, I think, in new ways. Today, I think what we want to do is to take a quick look at where we are in race relations in the United States, because I think it's arguable that in lots of ways, from the president on down, the nation has been napping about race relations, too, in the last decade. And it seems to me clear that's going to catch up with us one of these days as well. So that's the sort of general outline of the rubric of this national nap business. Does that make sense to anybody else? Is there a feeling that that's right? The other thing to say about that, it seems to me, is that those of us who have been sort of active in the public realm for 25 years, I think, can remember a time in the United States where that wasn't true, where, in fact, discussion about the civic good, even though there was a lot of different disagreement about what it meant, what policies were called for and so forth, was very high on lots of different organizations and certainly in individuals' agendas. And in fact, there was a sense, if you traveled abroad, that the United States was still engaged in an interesting social experiment that had to do with small-d democracy. I don't get a sense about that excitement about a social experiment that much over the last 10 or 15 years, and I do think that taking the wind out of our sails in that sense is a real problem as a nation. And as you wake up every morning these days to stories about nations experimenting with their direction and rethinking themselves to the very roots of their being, whether in Eastern Europe or China or in fact, all over Asia, all over Africa, all over Latin America, when you think about nations who really are reforming themselves in a very exciting way in lots of places, sometimes it seems like the United States is the dullest place in the world to be these days. That clearly hasn't always been true about us, and it seems to me probably that it need not continue to be true as well. Well. I want you to help me do about four things on race relations today, and each of them hopefully will involve us in some discussion together. One, I want to just see if we can share some basic indicators and get some sort of impressionistic reports from you about where we are in race relations in the United States today. Second, I want to work with you very briefly on some sort of basic distinctions around intergroup relations, some almost definitional kinds of stuff having to do with multicultural reality and race and racism. I want to test on you then briefly a little bit about the way in which institutions, not again persons, except as we are all part of institutions, but the way in which institutions interact with race in ways that that keep folks under the thumb. And finally, I'd like to get into some discussion with you about what you see as a challenge of multicultural being in the United States. I hope we can do it during, too, Ken. I should always introduce Ken. Ken and I have overlapped up in, it's always a joy to be with Ken at Holden. And I always introduce Ken as somebody who's never agreed with a thing that I've said over the last 5 years, but we always have fun arguing about it. So I'm always glad to see you here, Ken. Let me first say that I want to concentrate some of my remarks today on black and white, fully recognizing that the variety of Hispanic relationships, the variety of realities in Asian and Asian American immigration and multi-group relations are so critically important. The Native American scene is also critically important. I want to do black and white partly because it seems to me peculiarly American, and because it seems to me if we have to sort of pick a starting place from which one does comparisons of other kinds of group relationships, if we're in the United States, we have to start with black and white. Because in some ways it is the peculiar way in which race and racism works in the United States. So even though it seems to me clear that Hispanic realities in the United States and Asian realities in the United States in particular are getting so much more important, it still seems to me key to deal with black and white, at least as a starting place. And maybe one of the things we can do quickly in discussion is to do some quick comparisons. I've jotted down a couple of things, a couple of indicators here, of a basic thesis, and I'm not going to go into any detail on this, basic thesis that, in fact, after some 20 years of progress in race relations with respect to the black community in the United States, we've been sliding backwards since about the late 70s, 78, 79, by most indicators. That is, most indicators of equality showed the gap between white and black in income, the gap in the variety of job indicators and so forth, narrowing up until the late 70s, from really 1950 on, accelerating in terms of equality during the late 1960s and early 70s, and then now getting worse over the 80s. For instance, just going up to about 86, the poverty rate in the black community was as high as 55% in 1960. By 1970, was reduced to 32%. Lots of things have to do with that's lots of things explain that, including the boom economy of the Vietnam years. But remember that was also the decade that a lot of social experimenting was going on in terms of government programs and Great Society and so forth. And it's important to think about numbers like that, particularly after a decade of hearing people criticized the effects of those programs. Clearly, some of it worked. Clearly, lots of it didn't, too. But that's a huge jump, huge dip in the poverty rate. We held our own, kind of, from 70 to 80, although if you looked at the internal statistics between 70 and 80, 32% to 33% in 80, you would see the poverty rate go down under 30% in the middle of the decade and then begin to rise by 80, and then the latest numbers I looked at, somewhere around 36, and we're a little bit higher than that, 38% or so of the black community in poverty today. Another couple of indicators, black male unemployment. One of the we hear so much about the feminization of poverty and about the number of children in poverty and so forth. Part of the factors that are involved there is the relationship to the economy for black males. 9.6% in 60, down to 3.7% in a full employment economy or close to it in 70. In 80, right after 80, the recession of 81, 82, 83, it zoomed up near 19% and leveled off back down to about 15% and is now about 13 or 14%. So it's leveled off at a rate much higher than in the 60s or 70s for black males. similarly, black families with a female head, something like the same pattern holds. An overall trend then of some progress until the mid-70s, a leveling off and then not a precipitous decline, but a kind of decline. Because of a variety of factors in the 1980s. Overall, the black community is impacted hardest by economic trends, so that these first half of the decade trends in poverty impact black folks harder than they do anybody else. So that when you see that the poorest 40%, this is about income trends over the first half of the decade, the poorest 40% of families in the United States lost $236 in their income. In other words, the poor got poorer. The wealthiest 40%, most of the upper middle class anyway, gained a little over $2,000 in real income. These are 1985 dollars, as I recall. And the wealthiest 10% gained something over $7,000 in income. So you really do have a further skewing of the income patterns in the United States during those years. It seems to me important. Yeah.
In the
early 3.7. Yeah, that was, as you recall, as close to a kind of full employment economy as we've gotten, and it's partly because of the Vietnam War. Absolutely, police action. Right. Congress never declared war. That's exactly right. So that 55,000 young men died for police action. Right. One of the things that's happening here, let me just make a quick 30-second detour into the economy. One of the things that's happening here, it seems to me, is that minority communities, at least black and Hispanic. Hispanic statistics look a lot like this, by the way. Asian statistics are more scattered. That is, some of them are as bad as this, some Asian immigrant groups, and others are much better than this. And you know, I'm sure, in your own experience, which immigrant groups are faring better within the Asian community than others. And of course, at the bottom of all of these are the Native American groups, the worst kind of, much worse than the black community statistics or statistics that you get in the Native American community. I think that we talked about a little bit in the economy session. One of the things that's happening here is that the economy is changing in a way that is removing, to some degree, the what we used to think about as the ladder of opportunity. This is going to work. If the dream of immigrants to the United States used to be that you would catch on to the bottom rung of the ladder and pull yourself up to the second, gradually getting yourself into the mainstream of the economy, and by the time you got to the second or third, you would then be able to hand over to your children a better life by doing what? By sending them to school, right? By educating them. It seems to me that what's happening in the economy now is that this bottom rung has disappeared. So the people who are stuck in poverty now simply can't reach the second rung of the ladder. What's happening, it seems to me, is that these jobs, these bottom rung jobs, at least in cities, were the older industrial jobs. The kinds of jobs that you used to find in auto, in steel, in the old blue-collar industries, where people who were simply willing to do back-breaking labor at not very great wages could go into the mills and find jobs, right? In war after war, that's how black folks came to the northern cities. They were recruited from the south by major industries to take the place of white folks who went to war, right? And they started, along with other major immigrant groups, at this bottom rung of the ladder. Those are precisely the jobs, as the economy has shifted from an industrial to a post-industrial or industrial to service kind of economy, those are the jobs that are gone. Chicago, my own city, has lost something like 400,000 jobs over the last 15 years. And a huge proportion of those are these kinds of first rung of the ladder jobs. Right? So what you hear, it seems to me, what we are hearing about when we hear terms like the urban underclass, right, which is not a term that I'm very fond of myself, is we're hearing about a group of people who are cut off from the mainstream economy and who are doing everything they possibly can to invent an economy of their own, using anything that's handy to do that, right? That structural difference in the economy, the lack of entry-level jobs that lead up a ladder, I think should cause us to rethink some of our notions about poverty and race. In place of these low-paying, it doesn't mean there's no low-paying jobs in the society. What it means is that in the new service sector, you've basically got two tracks of jobs. In the Reagan administration, they take credit for something like 18, 19 million new jobs being created in the 1980s. Somebody looked at those jobs and found that something like 65% of them were paid less than $11,000 a year. In other words, less than poverty wage figured to full time, right? The others are the new yuppie professional service sector, finance, real estate kinds of jobs, the kinds of jobs that require more and more education and that in fact do have upward mobility built into them. These jobs are characterized not only by low pay and increasingly by the fact that they don't need much skill, but they're also characterized by the fact that they don't lead up any kind of ladder. There's no way for a cashier at McDonald's to move up into the hierarchy of McDonald's Corporation. I think one hears occasional stories about that happening, but it's not built into the structure of things. In the way that, for instance, you could start as a laborer in a steel mill, and as you become part of the United Steelworkers, you know those jobs are graded, right? And you move up 30, 35 grades of job and at some point you can leap into being a foreman, leap into management. The new service sector jobs just don't have that ladder built in. So that part of the poverty we're dealing with, it seems to me, has to do with the changing nature of the economy and dealing now with an economy that doesn't have built into it the possibility for mobility. Okay. I'd like to hear briefly from you all whether or not in your section of the country you can see some developments of this increasing problem for non-white peoples, whether they're black folks or Hispanics or Asians. Is there evidence of this sort of growing portion of our population that's cut off from the economy where you are?
I don't know. I basically agree with your premises here, but I feel that in our area of the community, Tri-Cities, just down the river here, a couple hundred miles, we have a difficulty of getting the blacks and the Hispanics into the middle class. And that's what you're seeing with your ladder. And basically, the problem is, as I say, is a basic one of education. If you can get the kid out of high school with something in the way of physics and mathematics and chemistry, where he can go into a semi-technical job, where you can get him out of the high school with enough brains into a technical school that'll accept him, where he can use his mind. You can start him into a technical school where he can go on to a middle class job. But the blacks and Hispanics, as I see it, in the 60s and 70s, they were coming alive with self-determination to, I want my kids to go to school to mm-hmm. learn to be better. And I think that self-determination drive has fallen off. And that I think many families now aren't out there pushing their kids for doing well in school, in high school, so that they go on to a technical school and get through a technical machining aspect, a welder or whatever,
okay,
so they can go on to a middle class job.
Whether or not the drive is there, though, and one of the things you're saying, I think, is that in terms of getting out of poverty these days, education is a key, which really is different. I mean, you know, if you and I were poor 50 years ago, we could say, if I'm willing to go out and break my back, I can make it in this country, and my kids will go to school. Now, if I'm poor, I got to go to school in order to make it in the economy. Yeah.
I live in Tacoma, Washington, mm-hmm. and it seems like the biggest problem in the black community in Tacoma is crack.
Mm-hmm.
It's having a serious effect on almost all the good that was done over the last 20 years. And the community is trying to mobilize against it, but it's very difficult when the money is so,
yeah,
it's so easy to get rich so fast, dealing crack and the gangs are coming up, the Crips and the Bloods are coming up from Los Angeles. So that's a serious problem. Just another observation, listening this morning to the lady who did the matins, reading the quote from Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
it struck me that almost all of the indices of discrimination that he ticked off are now gone. There are no, the obvious discrimination, you can't get in, you have to have a whites-only drinking fountain,
mm-hmm.
and certain jobs are not available, and you can't get into this amusement park, etc. But the one that was not, when he said, and keep my people in poverty,
mm-hmm.
that is still there. And it occurred to another thing that I read, George Will, who no one would term a Marxist,
mm-hmm.
heard Marxist say at one time, he said that it seems clear that the problem in the black community is now economic and not race. He says that nobody would seriously think that if all the black people in the ghetto turned white, immediately their problems would go away. Because in fact, that's not what would happen. They would be still mired in the same kind of poverty that they were. I'm not sure that's true, but it's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Well, in fact, one does find poor white communities in which a lot of the stuff that you're describing is also rampant. I mean, we'll be talking, I think, a little bit more about the hopelessness that you're describing related to crack. But one of the things to say about the drug economy in lots of communities is that it is part of this economy, what economists call the informal economy, that sort of operates separate from anything that is a part of the formal economy. And it's not only drugs, but it's a lot of informal interchange of stuff that would be perfectly legal as well, but not stuff that you would find on the IRS returns, right? The drugs, though, seem to me partly an indication of increasing hopelessness, of increasing recognition that there is no way onto this ladder, and that maybe even a high school education isn't going to do it for a lot of people. Ken?
Well, I'll tell you some of my experience. I was a chef at the Tacoma Golf and Country Club,
mm-hmm.
and we had all black waiters. And I was always, my head waiter was a jewel, a prince, a tremendous fellow. We got along fine, but I was fighting with all the rest of them. And I'll tell you what, you have your side towel, they'd wipe their face, it was hot, wipe their plates off and send it out to the people. And I don't believe in that sort of thing. I believe in keeping things clean, and that isn't it. I went to Uncle Sam asked me, he didn't ask me, he told me to go to join the Navy, and I went to Farragut. And the big problem there is I was in charge of all of the grills, and we were feeding 9,500 people. And the southern blacks, easy to get along with, fine. The northern blacks were always feeling sorry for themselves.
Hmm.
And the Jim Crow papers that came out of Chicago, where you live, kept preaching that to them. And it isn't my war. Why are we here? Well, it isn't mine either. But would you be better off under the Japanese? And of course, I don't know, maybe this has improved, but we were always ending up in a big battle, and then we'd have to have the commissary together, and they didn't want to learn, and they were always coming in late, and the idea was this, that they see the white people coming on time, and they'll conform. But they finally, and you could, weren't supposed to fire him, but they ended up calling him Simon Coote.
I know you've got endless stories like this, Ken. Let me ask you to hold a couple of them for later on.
Crosby.
Yeah.
You look at TV.
Yep.
You see more black people on TV than you do white people. Look at the pro football, pro basketball, baseball. They made the black people that are getting in and work have gone to the top. Those that don't want to are still down at the bottom.
Well, I am pleased to hear you making some good distinctions among a variety of folks from different kinds of backgrounds. It seems to me that that's absolutely right, and I know that you've been struggling with these questions yourself for lots of years and trying to figure them out, and I appreciate your comments about them. I think that trying to understand behaviors only within the categories of race sometimes gets us into some trouble, right? I mean, I can oversimplify on my end by talking about the way in which color has put people in an impossible set of situations which they can't get out of. And I think that your set of arguments tends to be that virtually anybody who finds himself in virtually any situation, by dint of hard work and being on time and putting their nose to the grindstone, can make it. I think that part of my argument is that may well have been true, at least in some segments of the economy, at some points in our past, and that it may still be true in some parts of in some sets of situations. But that for lots of folks, Ken, I think things have really changed. I think that it's more and more difficult to put singular expectations for success on people who are trapped in some ways that we need to understand institutionally. Can I shift gears for just a second here and see whether it's possible to talk about different ways in which whites and blacks interact? There aren't more blacks than whites on television, even though there are in the NBA at this point. I mean, I think you're just wrong about the TV part, Ken. But it's always been true that success, partly for black folks, has been available in the entertainment realm and in sports and athletics. So you certainly do find lots of black folks succeeding in those two areas, and lots of white folks pointing to that as ways of sort of exonerating ourselves for any sort of implied guilt that the larger society has. I guess I have to argue with you, and suggest to all of us that there are relationships that have to do with power and with a kind of continuing racism that are important for us to think about. I find it helpful, though, to distinguish a little bit among different ways in which that works. Let me just ask you to help me for a second. Let me put up four terms here. And ask you to help me define them. Prejudice, cultural arrogance, racism, and institutional racism. Do they strike different chords within you? Right? Are these four different things? I guess I'm arguing that they are four different things. I want you to help me figure out how they are. All right. Give me a shot at prejudice, somebody.
Prejudice, you use prejudge. You label the person. This is what it says, doesn't it? You,
to as, prejudge.
As trapped, as in the bottom area, or as only
one. For instance, I have real problems with physicians. Because my experience, my life experience is that they're so terribly greedy. I really have problems going to a doctor because I know that I am only a cash register item. Mm-hmm. And I try to believe that he's concerned for me, but he's really concerned for his fee. So I have prejudice
against doctors.
I'm clear, but I have prejudice against doctors. It's a non-rational
prejudgment.
Okay.
Well, it's not even a prejudgment. I mean, you judged on the basis of some experiences as you have perceived them.
Well, that's why it doesn't go away. But it's in the realm of not an open.
Yep.
I think racism has the element of fear. You're afraid of that.
Okay. Let me just stick with the prejudice for a second. Let me just. I think you've gotten most of the elements here. Let me read one that we've worked out. It's about attitudes and opinions, right? It's not about systems. It's not about the way in which people are weighted. But attitudes or opinions, especially of a hostile nature, based on a prejudgment and insufficient information about a group of people. Yeah, you've got enough. This may be based on too much experience to be prejudiced. Although from
really need a physician,
That's right. From the point of view of the doctors, they would say it's based on insufficient, based on prejudgment and insufficient information about a group of people. Okay. All right. Let's go. Let's just take them in order, because I think there's a sort of flow to it. Try the cultural arrogance one. Good, lots of elements. Here's one other shot at it. The lifting, this is within the American context, the uplifting of the Anglo-American, that is white European, style of life, so that racial and ethnic groups are defined by Anglo-American standards, right? If you want to worship right, you worship in the LBW, right? If you want to be educated, you're educated in the canon of European literature, English and so forth, right?
You study German theologians.
Right. The results of this is the exclusion of the beauty, richness, and values experienced in other cultures. Right. Some of that, I think, is going to be nicely stretched for all of us in different ways over the next week in our worship and music here at Holden. Okay, racism. You were going to start on racism. At least as a motivation, huh? As a part of why one would enter into.
I mean, when people hear, that the percentage of Hispanics is increasing and and things like that.
Asians are just going to take over.
Mm-hmm.
No, the Asians.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say to my people in my adult science school class that we're the minority when you put us alongside the rest of the world, that shakes them up a little.
Yes, absolutely. And it's clear, isn't it, that white Europeans are what are we, 10% of the global population these days? We should begin to recognize reality.
For the church, even to be told that the shift of Christianity, is to Africa.
Maybe. That's right, south. Absolutely. Other comments about racism?
Is the element of power in racism, or is that just an institutional
aspect? Well, at least the way I'd like to use racism, power has something to do with it, yeah. It is a learned behavior, absolutely. We're not born that way. Let me try one to put together a lot of the elements you're suggesting here. Any attitude, action, or institutional practice. So we're dealing all the way from institutions to individuals here, right? Any attitude, action, or institutional practice which subordinates people because of their color is racism. It subordinates people because of their color. Alternative definition is racism is power plus prejudice. That lots of people can be prejudiced. And that virtually all intercultural or intergroup relationships are in some ways prejudiced because we all have a certain amount of ignorance about groups that we're not part of, right? So it's possible, in fact, to have black prejudice under this set of distinctions. But it's probably not, in most cases, possible, at least in the United States, to have black racism under that set of distinctions, right?
Way back when I was in fourth grade, during the Second World War, we used to sing a song, "When the Bueller Says We Is the Best to Raise We Will."
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. That's right. I don't know if this is how you want to do it, but for me, it is helpful to have a category, and I can call it racism and be at home with it, which really is about power relationships defined within our own cultures. And it's helpful for me to think about ways in which black folks can be prejudiced, but only white folks can be racist. To make that kind of distinction is helpful for me because it allows me to put people, locate them in their social position, their social, economic, political position. There's not much that an angry black community can do about my livelihood or about the institutions that I belong to. But there's an awful lot that the institutions that I belong to, schools and communities and churches and businesses, can do to exclude black folks. And they do. All of them. All of them.
There is what is referred to as reverse racism.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons.
You're
talking about affirmative action, for instance. Yeah, I would like to reserve, what I'm suggesting is for my own understanding, I would like to reserve racism so that it couldn't be used in the way that you just used it. I don't think it's helpful. In other words, it seems to me that it's different within a definition of racism that is power plus prejudice if you think about how to redress inequalities, how to, in some ways, equalize power relationships. And to call that in any way racism seems to me to be wrong, or at least intuitively, it's not about the same thing, right? It's a different set of problems. Now, that's not to say that people can't have problems with that, with the idea of affirmative action, but it just seems to me to confuse the categories to understand that under the rubric of racism.
Probably ought to use the word just white racism.
Yeah, I think that's basically what it is in the United States, at any rate. Finally, institutional racism. Okay, that's certainly one version of it anyway. Others? I think it's a problem in terms of translating it into not only legal practice, but in terms of figuring out social policies to address it. But I think that I would, nonetheless, for purposes of understanding, I would argue more for your definition, it seems to me. I think that when we're looking at large segments of Chicago or Tacoma, that what we're looking at is the perfectly normal sunrises in the east functioning of institutions that have absolutely no intent to put acres and acres of desperately poor people into existence. But they just go ahead and do their ordinary business. We just go ahead and do our ordinary business with our own institutional standards pointing our way, and the result is huge tracts of poor people, a much higher percentage of which than would be normal, of whom are called people of color. Right? Let me just play one more. Here's an attempt here to define institutional racism more in that way, I think. Policies and practices of basic institutions, for example, business or healthcare, education, government, religion, which result in benefits to people of one race at the expense of those of other races. Again, that's result test. That's not intent test. And it seems to me that, at least in terms of understanding what's going on, that's probably a better way to start. Let me just briefly share this attempt to try to figure out how race works in a city. A friend of mine and I did a piece a while ago called The Web of Urban Racism that was meant to sort of think about what the world looked like from the point of view of somebody within the middle of an impoverished black community in the city of Chicago, and what the major institutions looked like. And what we came up with was this sort of image of a web, of a spider web, with a black community, poor black community. Now, we're talking not about the black middle class, which I think in many ways has exited some of this in ways we might want to think about. But we're talking about a community in which virtually any set of institutions has, in modern cities, a dual track, so that you can talk within the job area of a dual labor market. Lots of economists are working on that, that there's a separate market that sorts out blacks for work from the one that sorts out whites, particularly middle class whites. That the education tracks are the kind of things we were talking about earlier. Even the word of mouth stuff is very different. That you see the same thing if you look at the education system, that there really are two kinds of education. The kind of education that I think in lots of ways is constructed to fail, that we find in our large cities and public school systems, versus the kinds of education systems that we put together when we want children to succeed. Right? Two separate kinds of, certainly two tracks in the housing. I mean, all of the measures through the 1980s tell us that we're getting more segregated as a society, not less. And those of us who live in big cities know that it's still true, even though the laws are no longer on the books, that real estate agents show one set of houses to black folks and another set of houses to neighborhoods to white folks, and that there's two markets in housing. Really, there are two kinds of media. There are two sets of media. There are media that are basically white-dominated, and those are the national media, and those are the big downtown media if you're in cities. And there are local, much more low-budget, much less flashy ways of communicating within oppressed communities. There are certainly two healthcare systems, one for the poor, close to 40 million people now without health insurance, an increasingly overburdened public health system, sort of segmenting out the poorest third of the population in terms of health care. And obviously welfare is meant in many ways to segment off and to separate off the way of life of poor people. So that we have problems when we think about what it is we want to do about these sets of questions. Because if we start any place, like we wanted to start at education before, we find that education is directly affected, because it's part of a web, by people's perception of and the reality of the labor market, which is right next to it. That is, kids say to me in Chicago, tell me why I need this high school diploma. Tell me where the jobs are in my community, right? Tell me what this is good for, right? And they're right. They say, okay, I say there's some marvelous jobs out there at Argonne Laboratory. And they say, show me the housing that's available for me, any place out there that's going to let me get out to that set of jobs. So we're talking about an education system that is impacted by all of the other systems, right, in a way that catches people the way that spiders catch flies, right? And that the more you thrash at one of these things, at housing or at the jobs or healthcare or education, the more you find that some of the other aspects of the institutions are increasingly trapping people. Right? Sometimes the result of that is to throw up our hands in frustration, I think, and walk away from the problem. As a nation, that's what we've done. We've spent the last 15 years throwing our hands up at the problem and walking away from it, it seems to me. And allowing these sets of institutions to simply continue on their own route, I think. One of the sets of distinctions here is that in each of these, the major institutions are, we're basically seeing a white set of institutions determining what happens, right? A white-controlled set of institutions. And then sometimes there are sub-institutions controlled by blacks. One quick suggestion, since we're getting near the end of the hour, it seems to me that there's some interesting differences both in the realm of politics and in the realm of religion, where you have some space that is beginning to be controlled by, defined by, the black community. In Chicago, we went through a little bit of that with the redefinition of political life with our first black mayor, Harold Washington. That's happening at least to some degree in cities across the country where political power shifts to the black community. Too often, obviously, that happens only when the economic clout of the city has dwindled to such a degree that white folks no longer much care about it, right? But in Chicago, that wasn't true. In politics, it seems to me to be one realm where it's possible, certainly there's a lot of racism in politics, but one realm where it seems to be possible for black folks to cut out a piece of the action and at least determine its direction in some degree. The other realm where that's true, it seems to me, in our life together is religion. It has historically been true that the black church has been the center of vibrant and faithful participation in public life for folks, and that leadership in terms of defining the civic direction for the black community, and I think often for the nation. You talked about Dr. King being quoted this morning at breakfast. Has come out of the religious life of the black community. It seems to me that, that somewhere in the religious life of white and black communities is some possibility for redefining the power relationships that that determine this kind of thing. So if I have hope, which sort of every other day I do, and by the way, I have more when I'm when I'm in black communities than when I'm not. I find certainly more to hope for in black communities than I do in this area than I do elsewhere. But it's in these two realms. It does seem to me that increasing activity of particularly in cities of black political life and increasing vision and power in the black religious life would be two things to look at. Okay, quick concluding prompt.
If you would do some research, you would find that most of our machinery, cars, and everything are produced by non-whites.
Well, we're certainly part of a...
This is going to Japan, Korea, and I know that car, they have a plant in Mexico.
That's right. Yeah, there are now 600 plants right along, at least 600 plants right along. Well, the reason those cars are getting made, though, in third world countries by people of color, Ken, is because decisions to go there to make those cars were made by the leaders of those corporations, right? And they made them on the basis of labor being cheaper, right? And labor is cheaper there, just south of the Mexican border, than it is in inner city Chicago, right? They certainly had a choice to
so
move
then
their...
You can blame the
their,
unions, can you not? Really?
Well, it's it's true that organized labor sometimes means people get better wages. Now, I think we need to have a discussion about the way in which we'd like to see our... the way in which we'd like to see our work life organized, right? And whether part of the way we want to organize our work life has to do with letting people make a living wage at it.
Right. Is this not right to give those people in a foreign country a chance of the pie? Give them a chance to make a decent wage over there?
Well, it's certainly a fact of life. Whether or not we think it's right, right? It's certainly a fact of life that we're in a more and more global economy at this point. And that, in fact, more and more of our inner city looks like third world, right? And is, in fact, like the third world in terms of the way the economy works, right? Some of the stuff that gets me most excited and interested in inner city Chicago about what's happening is exactly development projects that sort of have as a model what works in third world countries. That is, one of the things we've learned about development in third world countries that is that unless people really have a stake in what's happening, whether that means ownership directly or some kind of say over what's being made and how it's made,